Welcome to PDX Food Stories. I'm your host, Mary Crow, and today on the show, I'm excited to host my friend and impact strategist, Amelia Pape. So, full disclosure, Amelia and I worked together for several years while she was running her mobile grocery business, and her work began to impact the way that I think about food, my access to food, and my privilege when it comes to the range of choice for what I buy and what I eat. So today's show is by no means a light topic. Food access is a huge issue here in Portland and in the state of Oregon. We're one of the hungriest states in the nation. And I ask Amelia, what's our responsibility as people who love food, who spend our discretionable income on food? How can we create impact and awareness? So it's a deep one. I hope you'll stick with it. Because at the end of the show, Comic Relief is back. Sarah and Dirk and I look at turmeric or turmeric, however you choose to say it. This root is enjoying its moment in the sun. Culinary magazines are writing it up. Just about any way they can get it into any dish, they'll find a way. So hope you'll give it a listen, and we'll catch you on the flip side of the show. All right. Well, Amelia Pape, welcome to PDX Food Stories.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited.
Yay. I'm glad to see you.
You too.
Today we're going to talk about a big topic that you and I have had discussions about before around food security. But before we get there, you are a food person, and I know you come from the South and you have your food traditions, and I want to hear, like, tell me, what is, like, how does food make you who you are?
Such a good question. I've thought about it a lot over the years because I've always loved food, but I didn't have a real grasp on what that meant until I kind of incorporated it into my career. Ever since I was a little girl, I've always loved cooking and exploring food. And my parents love to tell this story that when I was like a toddler, I was really into this concept of mixing different things in bowls. So they would give me like some beans and pasta and a cup of water, and I would just mix it up, and I called it a cat treat. Of course, the cats never.
They just never bought into it.
I don't know what their problem was. They didn't eat the treat. But I've always been fascinated with food, and people over the years would say, like, well, you should go to culinary school if you love food. And I kind of thought about it, but I felt like food wasn't my end game. Food was kind of more of a medium for me. And when I went to grad school, I went to get my MBA. And what I was interested in was using the power of business to create positive social change. And the topic that I ended up researching pretty deeply was food access and food security. And then I built a business around that. And it was really a social enterprise about improving fresh food access. But what I learned while I was there was that I wasn't really trying just to feed people. I was trying to create an experience through food. And I kind of learned that from my customers who would come and be grateful that there was affordable, fresh, healthy food, but they talked a lot about the community that came about and how food is actually just this kind of tool that enables us to come together and to learn more and to connect with potentially otherwise, you know, people we wouldn't speak to. And so food is still something that I'm excited about just eating. Like, I love to cook and eat and go to restaurants, but I also really find a lot of joy in the power of food to create connection. So that's kind of the higher, you know, higher version of what food has meant to me over the years.
Okay, you just gave us like seven terms I feel like we need to define. But there are terms that are floating around out there. So positive social change, right? That was the first thing. So loosely, like, what does that mean if you're looking to business for positive social change?
So when I use the term social enterprise, what I mean is a business that is designed around solving a social problem. And a social problem is sometimes a market failure. And sometimes, not all market failures are social problems, but many social problems are market failures. So sometimes, I mean, a great example of a market failure is a food desert.
Right.
Where there's a community that doesn't have reliable access to fresh, healthy food. And you can solve that, in theory, with business. So a social enterprise defines a social problem mm-hmm. and then creates a business model around that. And the purpose of the business is to operate like a business, make money, do all the things that businesses do. But instead of having a profit motive, they have an impact motive. So the goal is just to really affect change around that social problem.
So is there an example, like a national example, that people might be familiar with? Or even a local regional here in the Northwest?
There's one model that I think really illustrates social enterprise well, which is not local, but it's in New York, and it's called Grayston Bakery. Mm-hmm. And they bake cakes and brownies and treats, and they hire people who are formerly incarcerated or formerly homeless or struggling to kind of enter the traditional workforce because mm-hmm. they don't have a resume and they have a hard time getting hired. And they sort of, their big success story is they won the contract with Ben and Jerry's to make all the brownies for their ice cream. But their tagline is, we don't hire people to bake brownies, we bake brownies to hire people.
That's awesome.
And I think that that kind of shows that, like, it's nuanced, but it's also really important to demonstrate that difference where the cakes and brownies are just a medium for building job skills and dignity and creating networks of people that otherwise are isolated and sort of excluded from traditional opportunities.
Okay. And what about food access, food security, food insecurity? What are those?
Good question. It's so complex.
They're logical words, right?
Yeah.
Like, food security means like, I'm secure in that I have food. But is that really how we think about what food security or what food insecurity means or food access?
Yeah, I think it's really great to define it yourself because it's kind of an evocative term. I mean, food mm-hmm. in and of itself is evocative and emotive, and then the idea of security really means something to people. So I like your definition, and it's absolutely right. The academic definition of food insecurity is the state of being without reliable access to a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food, which is like a mouthful. I could barely get it out.
Mouthful. And by access, we literally mean like you cannot go get it or it is not brought to you. It's like you are without.
Yeah. So that's the other kind of complex piece is, what does access mean? Mm-hmm. Is it just having it there in front of you?
Right.
And what I believe after working in this realm for a while is that it's so much more than that. And a lot of people have kind of come to that. Food banks are even understanding that just providing people with emergency food is an important thing in an emergency. But mm-hmm. When people are using that type of food as their primary food source, then there also need to be tools to make it more accessible, like education and food literacy, cooking skills, cultural appropriateness, social appropriateness, all of the things that actually make something possible mm-hmm. rather than just, you know, the idea of like looking at a vegetable that you've never seen before. And sure, it's there, but can you afford it? Do you know what it is? Do you have a place to cook it? Will your kids eat it? There's so much to it.
Right. There's like 9 ways I want to go with this. So I think, you know, back to like the basis of our conversation today, we live in Oregon, which is one of the hungriest states in our nation. Mm-hmm. But recently those numbers have fallen, which is great.
Yeah.
We have awesome partners here like the Oregon Food Bank doing really amazing things, but we're still higher than the national average.
Yeah.
But we're also a community of people who love to eat. We have abundance at our farmers markets. We have abundance in our growing season. The fact that like right now it's 55 degrees, you could probably be pulling radishes out of your raised beds in your front yard if you wanted to, if you had planted them back mm-hmm. in November. And that there's so many pop-up events to go to. There's Kickstarters to fund for people who are doing things with food. It seems like we're such an engrossed food culture. How are we living in a state then that is so hungry? And is that our problem as foodies to solve? And that is so huge. And I totally mm-hmm. don't expect to like solve that problem today. But the reason why I wanted to bring it up with you is because you and I worked on a small project together, just that eating on a food stamp budget for, what was it, a month, 30 days, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember when we first started this project, I said something pretty arrogant to you, or maybe not arrogant, but definitely tone deaf in that, well, people should just be able to do this. You should just figure it out. Just budget it, buy it, cook it, eat it. Fine, it's done. I don't get it. Like, self-responsibility. Yeah. And you were like, I'll talk to you in 30 days. And that, I feel like going through that exercise, even though I feel like it feels weird to tell people like, oh, I'm doing a food stamp, you know, this fun little project. I'm on a food stamp budget this month. It did help me just see it through a lens, an access lens, like, do I get home early enough to start cooking brown rice from scratch or beans from scratch? Or did I remember to put them on the night before? Or will my family eat it? Am I throwing this down the drain?
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe let's start with just the mindfulness around hunger in our state.
Yeah, it's, I'm a huge fan of empathy building exercises, which I think is the power of the exercise that we did, the SNAP challenge, SNAP being the new name for food stamps, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And what, like you experienced and I experienced, and I think everyone who goes through it learns, you do kind of uncover all of those layers of access and what it means to try to make something accessible with all of the different kind of social determinants of health playing a role and everyday life playing a role. And I remember thinking about my work in trying to provide actual food to people in need and saying things like, you know, you should really try kale. It's really tasty. It's very diverse. It's only $1.50 a bunch. It's really affordable. And then I tried the SNAP challenge, and $1.50 for a bunch of kale was like, I mean, that's a quarter of my
budget. $5 a day.
Uh-huh.
Right?
And I can buy a pound of pasta for $1, and the calories are far greater in pasta in terms of quantity. And so it just enlightened me where we think, oh, people just have to make these choices. It's not a choice if you're living a life of urgency. And so that type of awareness, I think, is the beginning, just understanding what it means to be self-responsible and what we're asking of people when we say, just choose this. You have the information. It's right here for you, when choice is not necessarily on the table for so many people.
One of the things I didn't realize is how in places that people are living, they might not even have like a range or an oven. You might just have a hot plate and a toaster.
Exactly.
And you're not, you know, roasting butternut squash.
Absolutely.
With cumin and sea salt.
Absolutely.
If that's your situation. And yeah, that was, it was interesting because you had brought up that challenge to me after we had seen that challenge kind of in, you know, the media with Mario Batali and Gwyneth Paltrow, and that really left a bad taste in my mouth. But I will say, speaking of Mario Batali and then authors that have worked for him, like Julia Tertian, they include whole pages in their cookbooks with, like, great, you got through this cookbook. Now here's ways where you can give back and get involved when it comes to food banks or giving or supporting local farmers, etc. And I think that that would be really awesome if that were at the front of every cookbook, just reminding people that just the fact that you have this cookbook and that you are, you know, reading it at your leisure on a Saturday afternoon and dog-earing recipes, like if everyone had that luxury, that'd be pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of, it's kind of a Pandora's box situation, but all of this leads to a conversation about poverty and about institutionalized oppression and all of these big, heavy issues that you kind of can't separate from things like food insecurity and privilege. And if we can be mindful of our own privilege, we at least begin the journey to understanding and to action. And like you said, if that was in the beginning of every cookbook that we read and we just had a moment where we could remember and reflect on what the opportunity we have is and how we might just think differently about our neighbors, because food insecurity is invisible to the naked eye in so many cases. Mm-hmm. It's not only people who are houseless under a bridge. Children are disproportionately affected. Single mothers, in fact, are incredibly susceptible to food insecurity, especially because they're mothers and they will go without in order to feed their families.
Right.
Communities of color are disproportionately impacted. So there are all of these ways to think about populations that are affected by food insecurity, but you never know when you're just what student in your child's class might be experiencing food insecurity, or what colleague or person that you meet on the street or in the aisle at the grocery store. It's just hard to tell. And so if we can kind of remove some biases around what people should choose and what they should do, and maybe even remove the word should from from our vocabulary, I think that's a good first step. And it's hard, but it's worthwhile.
So back to the bigger question, which I don't expect us to solve, but you know, we'll probably be thinking about for a long time to come. Is it a foodie's place to reconcile the state of our state when it comes to hunger and their discretionary income going to restaurants and events and artisanal products? And I don't know. I mean, I don't want anybody to feel guilty. I certainly don't feel guilty when I purchase these things because this, you know, I'm not... That really is where all my extra money goes. My budgeting software will tell you. But I do think a lot about, you know, why isn't there more of this for everybody?
Yeah.
Or when you go to an event and you see a large national organization as the beneficiary, and that's great policy-wise, that's great, but like what about right here? Why isn't it that beneficiary?
So big. I think that when we, first of all, definitely don't feel guilty about enjoying food. That's the beauty of food. That's the bigger power of food. And that's one thing that I think is important to reflect on, is there's the nourishment level of food at the physiological level, like the base of Maslow's hierarchy of thing.
Yeah.
But there's also the power of food as a tool for joy and connection, like we talked about in the beginning. And that is also something that everyone deserves. So the idea that if you're poor, you should just take what you can get is depriving people of more than just calories. It's missing out on this quality of life that food can afford us. And so depriving yourself of that is not the answer. Just like, you know, your grandmother saying that you better finish your peas because there are starving children in Africa. And you're like, but are they going to eat the peas? Like, how does this work? But there are ways to, I mean, there are literal ways to kind of be mindful about how you celebrate food. You can support minority owned businesses and businesses owned by people of color. There's a really rich and beautiful food culture in so many different parts of even Portland that we don't think about. We have a lot of ethnic diversity outside of the city, and there's incredible food there, and there's incredible stories about food, and there's a lot for us to learn. And it's not a sacrifice on our part. Like, it's still really delicious and fun and exciting.
Absolutely.
So I think that we can still... Not only should we not feel bad about experiencing the joy of food, but we should like continue to do that and bring other people into it and support businesses that are providing a livelihood for people who are otherwise sort of just up against the odds because of systemic and institutionalized racism and oppression. That kind of brings us back into this whole conversation about poverty, but it can be celebratory and beautiful. It doesn't have to be like a compromise or a sacrifice or, you know, like feel bad about going to this fun food event or this fun restaurant, but just bring other people into it.
Right. One of the things that we talked about during that challenge as well, which also helped me shift my thinking out of this like robotic, logical, okay, well, if you have $5 a day, this is how you can break down, this is how many meals you're going to have, is this reminder about that everybody deserves that intersection of joy and food and community and food and breaking bread together. And it's that was probably like one of my bigger like aha moments. Like, of course, absolutely. Yeah. And it's very hard to do that on that very small budget.
It is. Yeah. So that's right. That's kind of the reminder that when people are struggling with food insecurity, it's not just that they're not getting enough calories. That's obviously hugely important, but it's also that they're missing out on this opportunity to commune and share.
Right.
And we do have the power to kind of support that through our dollars and through our own events and our networks. And that is one of the most fun things about food.
Absolutely. Yes, I created a cookbook club as just an excuse to bring together the women in my life that I enjoy hanging out with. I don't even care what we cook. I don't care what the book is. I just want to see your
exactly. But the food is the thing that brings it all together. I mean, that's
exactly.
That's just the centerpiece for so many important events in our lives.
Right.
Dates, weddings, funerals, celebrations. When somebody needs support, you send them a casserole when you don't know what to say. Food is this great gathering
it's kind of magnet. It's almost a love language.
It is.
It's the sixth love language.
Oh man, if I were still dating, I would definitely put that on my profile.
Love language.
Food is my love language.
I love it. So 2017, I feel like if there's a word to describe last year, it's the word woke. And there was a lot that I learned about last year. I feel like I did kind of come out of my Portland bubble. Do you think that awareness will shift to food hunger, or hunger, and then the root causes of hunger going to poverty and institutional racism and all of those big topics? Are we there yet, or are we still kind of in this place where we're really aware of, you know, just what's been put on the table in front of us this last year?
I think we still have a lot of work to do, but not to say that there hasn't been great work already being done. It's just, it's okay. I'm going to try to take the optimistic view. You know, I think it's important that we have kind of taken some of these really scary topics into the light, like racism and discrimination and sexual harassment and all of these really big, heavy topics that are really becoming mainstream, for lack of a better term. I hope that continues, because that's a great awakening, but we still have to change our institutions.
Right.
And those are the things that are, you know, that's turning the Titanic. That's changing the power structure, and that's a huge undertaking. But I do feel like there's been great progress in the wokeness about food.
Hashtag woke.
Food woke. Over the last 10 years, when I first started researching food deserts about 10 years ago, nobody even knew what that term meant. And now, not only do people understand it, but there are better terms to describe it more effectively and accurately. And there are major innovations happening in places like food banks, which weren't sort of necessarily created to be that, to be innovative institutions that provide regular food for people. It was originally an emergency food option. And so I think that the level of innovation around food, there are tons of amazing food startups and social enterprise food startups that are combating these incredibly huge problems with just their blood, sweat, and tears.
Right.
That's inspiring, and that's changed a lot. So I think we're getting there. I feel hopeful about the continuation of that.
All right. Well, ending on the hopeful note and shifting back to the joy in food, because I ask everybody, what are you excited about right now in Portland? What's giving you joy when it comes to food?
I am trying to spend time thinking about where I want to spend my dollars in support of this effort to kind of bring, not only bring different people into my food world, but enter into theirs and mm-hmm. learn about different food cultures. I think the Portland Mercado is one of my favorite places to do that because it's about community building mm-hmm. and food culture mm-hmm. and it's about social enterprise and creating a market for food entrepreneurs. And it's just a really beautiful thing to behold and to be a part of. So I really love that. And
what do you like to eat when you're there?
Oh my gosh. I don't think I can.
I know it's hard. I've never gone back to the same part twice. Yeah, there's too much to try.
Narrow it down. Yeah. But that's the beauty of it. It's kind of a dynamic experience. It's right. not just one thing every time.
Right.
And I just love when you start to dig in Portland, which is, you know, not widely known as a diverse city.
Right.
When you dig in, there's some amazing food culture. And, like, there's this incredible Ethiopian restaurant, Abyssinian Kitchen.
What? Where?
It's in Southeast. It's like...
It's not the one on Hawthorne.
No, it's where the old St. Jack used to be.
Oh,
on
yes.
Division-ish or Clinton, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, 21st.
Yeah.
Like, in between Clinton and Division.
Yep. It's so excellent. Good, and it's run by a family. And yeah. I asked about how they make the injera mm-hmm. bread, and the man who was serving said, I should really just get the expert. And he brought out his wife, and she told me her whole method and how she was doing it that day. And I mean, it was just, the food was awesome, and it was a great learning experience, right. and it was a family business, and yeah. it was just kind of everything you want. And that changes it from just really delicious food to right. really delicious food that also has a story to it.
Right.
And the power of that story is the thing that will keep people coming back. And, mm-hmm. you know, I learned some things about Ethiopian food, which is awesome. Maybe one day I'll try to make it.
I just buy it at all the shops on Killingsworth.
Yeah. I have not yet made that bread. I'm still trying to master sourdough, which is hard.
There's a woman, Sunite, who I work with, and she and I did a fundraiser together once, and she made the red lentil stew, and she made greens, and so I got her to give me the recipe, and then she told me with injera you can cut it in half, roll it up into cylinders, wrap those in cling film, stick it in your freezer. Because when you buy it up here on Killingsworth, there's a bunch of little Ethiopian markets, but you're buying like 12, you know, big right. round pieces that's a lot of food.
Yeah.
So you can freeze it and then reheat it later. Mm. And that was like game changer. Like I'd probably buy it every other week. I don't know. We make that red lentil stew all the time.
That's so good to know. I'm going to try that.
Pro tip.
Awesome.
What else? Anything else? Any place else that you... Any farmers or artisans who are making you happy right now?
Gosh, I mean, they all make me happy. I don't know if I have a specific, like a particular farmer that I'm more excited about than I always am. But I'm mostly, what I've been focusing on lately is what types of businesses are really out there to make a difference mm-hmm. and what types of food businesses are kind of trying really hard to do their business well and right. also to provide a service to the community in some way.
Who's on your radar there?
Well, I think that the Red on Salmon mm-hmm. is a really interesting project of EcoTrust that's supporting some food businesses and startups that have that in mind. There's a nut butter company called Ground Up mm-hmm. that is doing some really interesting sort of social impact work. Right. There's a coffee company called Central City Coffee, mm-hmm. which is not at the Red, but it's a social enterprise inside of Central City Concern, mm-hmm. which is one of Portland's largest social services agencies. And it's a coffee roaster, and they were built as a way to employ the clients of Central City Concern who were formerly experiencing homelessness and joblessness mm-hmm. And they were trained by master coffee roasters, and it's super high quality, amazing, like awesome. Portland level yeah, coffee. Right. But, and it costs what every other coffee costs on the shelf, but it's providing something much greater than just a really good cup of coffee. So sure. I'm excited about that. Gosh, there are so many examples, but it's just, Portland is filled with food innovators, and more they're looking to innovate around social impact, and that's super exciting.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, thanks. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for talking about this really important stuff.
Been a while.
1 month.
1 month yeah. since our last gathering around the mic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're officially
it's good to be back.
2018.
That's right. The new year has started. How are you doing with the winter darkness? Do you guys like it? Are you guys winter dark
people? We're into it.
Really?
I love it.
Yeah, this is like prime time for us. It's good. We're feeling good right now. While everybody complains about being sad and depressed, we're like, let's build a fire and play cards.
Yeah. You just stay inside. It's quiet.
I know, but it's so dark. And in my house, I am the only person apparently who likes to keep all the lights on all the time. Mm. But it's very dark, and at about 7:15, I'm like, well, I'm going to bed. So I am getting a lot of sleep, which is great.
Good. It's really good for you.
It's good for stress and weight loss and all that stuff I've read. So we'll see.
That's like my favorite weight loss tip I read. It's like, get lots of sleep. And I'm like, that sounds pretty easy.
Done.
You're like, well, I'm working on my weight loss goals. I'm going to go take a nap.
Yeah.
But I just, it's so dark. I've definitely hit like my peak. I am like this morning I was saying to Matthew that I'm like, I'm mad about it now. Like, I'm just mad. I'm mad that it's dark. I need it to be light until about 7:50. Even if that's just like dusk, that's my prep. Like, you can be dark at 8. That's dark time. But 6:30 is not dark time.
It's perfect for us because our daughter just stopped taking naps.
Yeah, so that's her bedtime.
Yeah. Bedtime.
It which helps
gives, it's dark.
It gives
bedtime.
Us like extra hours in
it's
our evenings,
weird.
Which
it's
is awesome.
7 o'clock and we're face to face and we're like, I don't understand. Like,
yeah, we have so much time on our hands.
What are we supposed to do?
Sleep.
Yeah,
no.
I guess you can sleep and lose that sleep weight.
So usually I think of citrus as being like the one thing that can get me through winter because it's like concentrated sunshine. But our topic today, which I'm hesitating to pronounce because I think they'll pronounce it differently,
so excited about this.
Is really, it could be like a sunshine root, a little winter pick-me-up.
Sunny Roots.
It has a...
It's my band name.
I like it.
Is that
the Sunny Roots.
A funk band?
Yeah. It would be a really good funk band name.
I would love to see you on the steel drums.
Yeah. It sounds like a band name that would be in, like, Scooby-Doo or one of those old shows, like, HR Puff and stuff or something. It'd be like, the Sunny Roots, and everyone comes out in, like, rainbow suspenders.
Yeah.
Oh.
Definitely not the actual name of the Sunny Root, which I'm waiting to hear.
Yeah. I say turmeric or turmeric.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Is it kind of a potato, potato, tomato, tomato thing?
If I'm not thinking about it, I say turmeric.
Me too.
But it's turmeric, right? It's like you're barely opening your mouth. You pronounce the middle R, right? Or the first R? Turmeric.
I didn't used to, but then Dirk kept correcting me and saying that there's another word where I add an R to, so you said that took that R out of turmeric. And so then I started thinking about it all the time. So I would say turmeric normally.
Turmeric.
But that R is there, so I don't know.
So
do we say it?
You know, just going back to like college essays, let's pick one way and be consistent.
Oof. Cool.
Okay.
Right? Let's do it. And that way there's only like one red pen circle. Instead of all the red pen circles.
Because either way, someone listening will be like, I wish they'd say it wrong. Right.
Well, that's good.
We're going to drive someone so crazy. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah.
So how are we going to pronounce it?
I say turmeric.
Turmeric.
Can you do that?
Turmeric. I can do it. I might not do it consistently. Okay. Turmeric. Yeah. We're talking about turmeric. So the reason why we're talking about turmeric is super exciting. One of our favorite producers at the farmer's market is growing it. And right now, I think they're the only ones. This could be the new Padron pepper.
Yeah. I think there's actually one other farm that started growing it this year.
So we've got Groundworks Organic.
We've got Groundworks. So Groundworks is where we first saw it at the market. Mm-hmm. Few years ago they started growing it, and I think over the years they've gotten better at it, like mm-hmm. it just looks and tastes better and better each year. I think it was kind of an experimental crop for them, and then I think I've seen it now at Gathering Together, which is also
where are they usually
an organic farm. They moved them down a little bit because now that the market's condensed,
right?
They used to be the very top farm stand on the opposite side of where Groundworks is, and now they're like down by the manager station,
right?
Yeah, but they're an organic farm based out of like Philomath. Is that where Camille's from?
Oh,
because she's right across the street from them.
I love their display of their greens where they use all those old crates stacked together.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got two farms growing it, and it's you want to touch it. It's so mm-hmm. cool looking. I love how Groundworks leaves the little shoot on there.
Yeah.
So people, I think, are most used to seeing this in like powdered form.
Mm-hmm.
Probably your first connection to it is the main ingredient in curry powder, Western curry powder.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first time I ever paid attention was in a curry recipe.
Right.
And even a lot of the first recipes I saw it in, you added so little that I was like, what is this really doing?
1/4 teaspoon.
Yeah. Everything else was so like either what you'd consider spicy or savory in the recipe. And then I was like, I couldn't tell you. You can really taste the turmeric in this.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of times it's used for color.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So... you don't need that much. If you see that it's 1/4 teaspoon, it's probably more just
because
about
the
color
of something. Because the littlest bit will stain anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my tips, is that anytime that you're working with it, wear gloves.
Complete
we have so
rubber
so we use
poncho.
Fresh and dried turmeric in our habanero carrot curry sauce. So we're processing it often. And we have black aprons just because of that, because everything else that we had was just like annihilated. Like it looked like hippie tie-dye aprons. So then we just went black.
Yeah. And your nail beds are also going to get stained yellow, and people think you have jaundice. It's,
yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, powdered and fresh. And I think seeing it fresh at the farmer's market makes me want to use it more in culinary applications. But I'll be honest, the piece that I bought like 3 weeks ago is still in my crisper drawer.
Well, the nice thing about it is that it does last a long time. I mean, you can buy it and you can keep it in your crisper drawer for a while. You can also process it and freeze it, and then it lasts a really long time. And that's what we do, so that we can use it all throughout the year.
So here, the reason I think also, too, why this is exciting is because turmeric is enjoying its moment in the sun as like the vegetable to cure all ailments, everything from like, you know, Goop, Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle website, to WebMD just touts the benefits of this this root. And so now we see it pop up in so many places. It's popping up in beauty products. The golden milk latte I'd never even heard of until a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And fresh, even when I just did a quick like Google search of Bon Appetit recipes, I found 49 recipes that they have already curated into an article about cooking with turmeric.
Yeah, I have a chapter in my cookbook because I didn't see it in any canning books, but I felt like it was something that was really relevant.
Yeah.
And there were so many health benefits, so we decided to focus on it. We did a latte and a mustard and...
Well, it's it's related to the ginger family, right? Is that word? It's like rhizome.
Yeah.
And so when I started thinking about, okay, how could you use this? I mean, really just like ginger, the possibilities are endless. It can be in dressings. It can be in stir fries. It can be in soups. It can be in salads. It can be pickled. Mm-hmm. It can be powdered. You know, so there are so many ways to use it, but I am a super novice here with this. I feel like it's one of those ingredients, too, that I feel like, ooh, this is precious. And so I keep saving it. and not actually using it when I need to just do it.
Well, that's the thing, is that it is expensive and it's small. Mm-hmm. And then if you are following a recipe that has you peel it, then you have even less to use.
Right.
So I like to give people tips for how to use all of it. So if you are to peel it, just know that you can save those peels. You can put them in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can use them for, I always say, liquid gold vegetable stock. So mm-hmm. if you're making vegetable or chicken stock, put some in there, and then it makes it this nice glowing gold color.
Is that recipe's in your book, Preservation Pantry?
It is, yep.
Okay, because a couple of years ago, you and I made some pressure canned soups,
mm-hmm.
and it came to your old space, and we used stock that you were already making.
Yep.
And I think that golden broth should be the new bone broth in yeah. terms of a restorative. I mean, so like some of the health benefits of turmeric, people talk about anti-inflammatory, and you and I were talking about how when you first started making this broth, like saving all of your peels
yeah.
in like big Ziploc bags, mm-hmm. and making the broth, that you immediately noticed like your knees didn't ache
yeah.
after standing on a concrete floor for yeah. 10 hours, which is kind of crazy.
It is kind of crazy because it, I mean, to me, like I don't ever really know the facts behind why things are good for you. You know, I'll read it. But then that was the one thing where I really did notice a difference. Like I, you know, when sometimes there's like some kind of craze where I'm like, oh, I'll try an apple cider vinegar shot or something. And I'm like, moving on forever
right,
from that.
Right.
But with this, I really did notice a difference. So then we started incorporating it into our daily meals. You know, any stock that we have is going to have it in it. We'll make tea to drink out of the peels too, with like lavender and honey.
Wow. So if you're at home and you're hearing this and you're thinking, awesome, I'm going to try that, how much really do you need of that turmeric, either peel, or if, let's say, like me, you have this whole kind of like 2-inch long by 1-inch wide kind of root system, how much of that do you need to add to your soup to give it
kind of
that
a lot.
Boost. Yeah.
I mean, we add a lot just because we have so much. So
right.
I would say if you're making, you know, like a pot of stock, I'll add like a cup of peels.
Got it.
But that pot is really big. You know,
right.
you're making
right.
quarts and
yeah.
quarts. So if you are just going to brew a cup of tea,
sure.
then you could use your little bit of peels
yeah.
that you have, you know.
Okay. I also read this morning that people will actually grind, speaking of medicinal uses, like they will grind it into a paste, and then they'll just topically apply it to reduce swelling, which is also crazy. And it made
yeah,
me think of the
I mean,
paste that I saw for sale in Vancouver, which I was like, awesome, I want to buy BC, not Washington,
mm.
Vancouver, BC, selling turmeric paste kind of like as a ready-to-go condiment for cooking.
Huh.
Which is...
That sounds really cool.
Right?
I've never seen it like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But it would be cool. I would think if you would put it on your skin...
Your skin would be yellow
it's
for a while.
It's gonna die. Yeah. Maybe people should use that instead of self tanner.
I have a turmeric stain on my shirt
oh,
right now.
Yep. There
so
it is.
There it is. Just like to wear that for the podcast, even though
yeah.
the listeners can't see it.
Wait a minute.
We know
yeah.
it's there.
Bringing the spirit.
Outfit matching the
do what I can.
Topic. I like
yeah.
it.
So how else? So powdered versus fresh then. I don't know. What I mean, then I feel like, I guess, you know, with the craze, my preference is like fresh, right? Because
mm-hmm.
you want the whole root, not this like dried powdered form. But could people get that? Like, let's say someone just added a tablespoon of powdered turmeric to their chicken stock.
Sure.
Do you think they get the same?
I don't know if they get...
Flavor benefits or...
I think the flavor's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the powder, I feel like it's, you get more of like the perfumey aspects of it
mm-hmm.
with the powder. And I think with the root, it feels more like a vegetable. You know, you
it's
get like
right.
some of
more
the,
earthy.
Yeah, more earthy. You get more of the juice from it, you know.
So so you use it for stock at home.
Mm-hmm.
And then any other like favorite application? Are there just ways you're like, ooh, I really want this? With turmeric.
I think that, I mean, it's great. Well, as far as canning and preserving goes, it's great for color. So you could use it in any kind of sauces that you want to have that nice glowy hue.
And you would use the fresh in the brine?
Yeah, I like to do both. Like if I'm using fresh, I'll usually also be using dry.
Got it.
And I also, you know, any kind of mustard you can put it into.
And mustard, is it for flavor or is it for color?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then one of my favorite tips, other than doing stalks or teas with the rind, is that then, or the peel, then you can also blend it up if you're making like a nut milk, like a cashew nut milk, yeah. And then that can make your, you know, golden latte. Right. But then you can take, you strain the pulp out of the nut milk. So then you have this turmeric nut pulp that then you can use in cookies or muffins or anything like that. Cool. And so then it adds like
body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like moisture.
What would you swap out? Like a portion of like your flour to add that pulp in?
No, it would be some kind of wet ingredient. So what I'll usually do is look up a recipe that makes something with applesauce and then I'll swap that out for it. So, so like a cookie recipe or a muffin recipe that uses that. Cause it is going to be like wet. So it's definitely, you want to swap it out with a wet ingredient.
What about just plain old pickled turmeric slices?
I haven't ever done it, because what happens when you pickle something that has a lot of color in it is that it pulls the color out of what you're pickling and, you know, puts it into the brine. So the brine would be really beautiful. So you could maybe do some like something that isn't so pretty and it would make it that color. But then the pieces of turmeric themselves would probably be kind of pale.
Right. Does turmeric have a turmeric? Whoa, sorry guys.
No big.
Redhead. Does it have a growing season? I mean, it certainly has like its time, but when I was researching, you know, it's like any you could plant it basically any time and after 10 months harvest it. But I feel like I've only seen it here in our winter months.
Yeah, we see it here in the winter.
It's definitely something that the chefs I spoke to would make recipes with the fresh ingredient, and if they didn't have it, then they would go to the dry. So that just tells me that there are times they can't locally
source it. Right,
they
can't get it. Yeah.
And then how do you process it to keep it in your freezer?
So we just peel it and then freeze it whole.
Oh,
and then,
really?
Yeah, and then we just, you know, blend it up and use it.
And what is your... It. So can you peel turmeric? Like the same way with ginger, like the back of a spoon, or do you use a peeler?
We use the back of a spoon just because the skin is so delicate, and if you use a vegetable peeler, it kind of takes off too much, you know, so we'll just use the back of a spoon and wear the gloves and go at it.
And then how did your, so I guess I'm curious, that how did the recipe development happen for the carrot habanero curry sauce? Were you already using fresh turmeric and decided, like, this is what this sauce needs? Or how did you come across getting fresh turmeric in that?
I think when we first started the recipe, no one had it locally. We were just using it. We would find it at Fubon was the only place that had it. So we used that. And then, you know, luckily, other farms started growing it.
We've covered how to use it, who is growing it, where to buy it. So you can buy it at the farmer's market from our two preferred and only vendors.
Yep.
And earlier when I was saying it could be the new Padron, as we talked about in the Padron pepper episode, that there was one farm who was growing those little peppers and then suddenly everyone.
Yeah, I think we'll see it more and more, and I think other people will too.
Yeah.
Cool. And then Fubon, if you're not finding it locally or you're not getting out to the farmer's market because you're angry about how dark it is and sleeping a lot to try and lose weight, you can make a trip to your favorite Asian grocer.
Yes.
I'm sure Wajmai also has.
They do. Yeah. Any of the ones on 82nd too. I've seen it there.
So I think most people, when they think of then using it in a dish, we automatically think Indian food, we think Southeast Asian food, and even Middle Eastern food. So I really can't wait to hear how Portland chefs are using it.
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to say thank you to all the chefs that respond to me. and I didn't think there would be that many for turmeric.
Yeah,
I thought I'll
I
get
also thought
two.
Aaron
maybe.
Barnett.
Our favorite.
There's
chef.
A twist. Wait till you hear about this. But first person to respond was Kasuma Rao that asked Rushikala.
Yes.
She didn't get too down to it because she said 90% of her recipes involve turmeric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So definitely check out Rushikala. That's her website for all of her dinners. She does beautiful breads and just
and cooking classes too.
And
if
cooking
you really
classes.
Want to learn how to use these products well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure. But today we're going to start with something different, which is drinks.
Because
this is
a twist.
This is an interesting ingredient. So first off, Best Friends, which is a food truck, a juice truck, I guess you would say.
Yeah, a beverage truck.
A beverage truck, right? Yeah.
Of adult or non-adult?
Non-adult. It's like coffee and smoothies and juices.
Awesome. And they do like little like where a nut they? Date bar. Ooh. It's right behind Genie's.
On Division.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, really great people. And they do a golden milk elixir with the turmeric, cinnamon, ginger, cardamom. There's another word. Cardamom. Cardamom.
Cardamom.
Is it? Mm-hmm. There's an M at the end?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. cayenne and coconut palm sugar is the sweetener in that. Sarah's. Nice.
It's so good.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Really once good. Sarah had it, we used to drive past there going to our old kitchen and could always find a reason to pull over and get one of those.
I'd be like, don't you need a coffee?
and I always do. Here's the Erin Barnett Lamuel twist. Is I'm going to talk about Lamuel for a second, but I'm going to talk about their bar manager, which is Anna Moss. And she is responsible for my favorite cocktail that is no longer on the menu because, she told me, it's been moved to the brunch menu. And that drink is the Golden Girl.
It's the best cocktail. But, okay, I'm sorry. How can you just have the Golden Girl? There are four to choose from. I feel
you
like
should have you all have four. A specific that's name. Why.
Yeah. And, but is this a Blanche or is it a Rose?
I think it's an overall love that the four share.
Oh, yeah. Like the warmth that you would feel if you were in their living room at them.
Like you take a sip and you're like, thank you for being a friend.
Yep.
I think that's
thanks
true.
For traveling down that road.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is this cocktail?
So it's Reka vodka, it's lime, ginger, turmeric, and Topo Chico. And then it has candied ginger on a little stick on top.
It I would like to try that.
Served tall, and it is
that. I guess
fantastic.
That means we have to go to brunch, huh?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes.
It's one of what I call a four-minute cocktail, because you take one sip and you go, oh, that's good. And then next thing you know, it's gone. And you're I guess I'm getting another Golden Girl.
Yeah.
Wow.
So good.
I was just thinking also, like, Pock Pock has the turmeric drinking vinegar, which I haven't actually tried.
I feel like we have at an event.
A tamarind drinking vinegar person.
Yeah, I think I've had it. It's great. Mm-hmm. I think they did like a mixed one. Like it was like they did basil and that one together. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then next, Diane Morgan, author of Roots, which has a chapter on turmeric, which is fantastic. She likes to make a turmeric tea. So we touched on that earlier, just kind of steeping it. And then she likes to add it to just plain chicken soup with, you know, rice and a soft egg on top. And I thought, that's interesting for people that are just getting into, wading into the turmeric pool, is to add a little bit to recipes you're already comfortable with and just see how that can change it, even just the appearance. Like, you could probably sprinkle powdered turmeric on your vegan mayo and be like, oh, look how festive this is now.
I love that idea.
Put some crudité out.
I just used some
out.
Vegan mayo this morning to make a turkey sandwich.
There you
I
go.
Wonder if Matthew would notice if I put turmeric in his vegan mayo turkey sandwich.
I think anytime you can try to sneak it into things, like you should,
Tune into the next episode where we find out if Matthew...
does he notice?
He's very good. Oh. Phone down. He's very good. He's learned not to complain.
Perfect.
Right. Oh, but I mean, I feel like it's true. Like, food definitely tastes better. I feel like when someone is making it for you, but if someone like volunteers to get up and make you lunch, he knows to throw it away at work, so I don't find it. Mm. It's one thing when you find your child's food is still completely intact in their lunchbox, but if your husband's food is also completely intact in his lunchbox, it's like double fail. Oh. All self-imposed, all my own.
And then going from Diane Morgan's turn there with the soup, we'll move into the food portion.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. And starting off with Heather Anderson, one of our favorite people. She's an author, a food historian. Her website is voodooandsauce.com. She says she really likes it in shakshuka.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is where you take tomatoes and harissa, peppers, onions, kind of make a little stew thing, crack some eggs on top. There you go. She said it adds a slight, bright earthiness to the dish.
Mm-hmm. You guys, I don't know her, but
you don't?
Sounds awesome.
She's the best.
We've got to introduce you.
We got to hang.
Website's great. Her, just her way of writing is really informative. She's written a number of books. say? Yeah, articles
unlike
for sure.
Food, Portland food history and
cool.
Things.
Yeah. Yeah, and she also said something from my nightmares, which I'm interested in your take. She said it's great for pickled eggs. I wrote double frowny faces next to that sentence.
It's been really fun to watch you talk about all these recipes that include eggs.
How are you with pickled eggs?
The only ones that I've had and liked have been from Gruner because they're very good. Okay. Beet pickled, so they had that gorgeous pink color. They're sliced in half, and then the yolk was whipped up with like horseradish and had horseradish on top, and the egg was just the vehicle for the flavor. It was awesome, and that's the only way I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Pickled eggs, and it's the only way I ever want to eat pickled eggs, because I think when you see them bobbing around in that, and they're always in a big jar too. Yeah. They're just in a small jar. They're always in like a quart size jar, and it just makes it all feel like when you find one tennis shoe on the side of the road. Yeah. Like something's not right.
Right.
I don't like it. I can't get behind it.
Yeah.
Even I can't either, but people love them.
People do love it. And it's interesting because you mentioned beets, because that's another ingredient that sometimes people use it just for color.
Right.
And if you use it right, then you don't get too much of the earthiness of the beet, but you can also go all in.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a future episode.
No, any desserts? Any dessert uses?
Well, going on down the list, a pief responded saying that a pief is a vegan Peruvian pisco lounge.
What?
Yes. We've been there. It's really good.
Could you explain that more?
Yeah. So they had a restaurant, I don't remember where exactly, for like 6 years, and then decided to come to Portland. And when they did the move, they decided to make it vegan completely all the way. So it's a Pisco Lounge, and then the whole
menu. Because a lot of Peruvian food. I mean, they usually will, their recipes will be vegan.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Well,
the dish,
I mean, yeah.
The dish like I'm going to mention here is mix. Usually made with seafood.
Interesting.
But this is a casa.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So you take a mashed potato, and then that is where the turmeric is to make it very bright. It's bright yellow.
Yeah.
And then they're rolled, the mashed potatoes are rolled, filled with vegan cream cheese, red bell pepper, asparagus, and chives, served with a Kalmata olive sauce. This is a dish that we had when we went there. And I just have to say that I feel bad for most vegan businesses because they have to say that their thing that they're making is this thing.
Right.
Which
right.
I think, and then it carries a weight because it's not going to be that thing. It's its own thing.
Yes.
And so I read vegan cream cheese and I'm like, I will sign out on both accounts of that.
Yes.
Thank you very much. But it was delicious. Mm-hmm. It was really good.
Was
really...
it a house-made vegan cream cheese?
Yeah. Mm. It's all done
in house.
Yeah,
they make everything in house.
Yeah, it's
Where
really
is
good.
It?
It's on 28th and just off of Gleason.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out for sure.
Yes.
And then lastly, and just a quick mention for David Sapp at Park Kitchen, he does a chow chow using the turmeric, which they top smoked mussels with. And this is a dish that we had. I'd never had smoked mussels before, and it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things, I hope if you get nothing else from my ramblings, is that I might not like something, but when it's prepared right, it's always worth trying because a lot of times I'll walk away with an understanding and an appreciation for that. And he did that for two things. One, the smoked mussels, and then two, the, was it boquerones? What were the little...
The white anchovies?
It's a small fish, and it wasn't fishy at all, and it was just straight up looking at me on the plate, and I'm like, oh, God, what are we doing here?
Eyeballs.
And I tasted it, and I'm like, how did you... And he's like, sherry vinegar. It's very simple. You just don't get too crazy with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, this is why
you
go to chefs.
Was the smoked mussel hot or cold?
Cold.
Cold.
Yeah. And it wasn't super smoky. It was... It wasn't a rubber band.
It wasn't
band.
Chewy.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking it was going to be chewy. Because I'd only ever had, like, the kind in a can, you know? And they're, like, kind of chewy.
Mussels are my nightmare food product.
Really?
Whoa.
Yeah. Is it a textured thing?
It's
or?
A textured thing. It's the way they look.
Oh.
It's the rubber bandiness. It's that... musky seafood smell.
I feel like you've had some bad mussels.
Yeah, I think you've had.
I've never
bad
had
ones.
Like bad mussels, like in the way that people have bad seafood.
Sure,
but I think you and I both share from our childhood like texture issues.
Oh yeah,
big time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Even now I'm pretty good. pretty good with texture issues. Yeah. You know, eat a chicken leg. There's some weird stuff happening there, but it's fine. I can handle it.
Yeah.
A muscle, I still just cannot handle.
Mm.
So I totally trust you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, it's one of those places I say, go try it if you're curious about that. Also, turmeric in chow chow.
Yeah. What's the chow chow base? Anything
I don't know, but he's one of the chefs that I mentioned where he uses fresh.
Right.
But when that's not available, he just goes to powder.
Huh.
So I don't know if you have to use more then.
Yeah. Is there, well, Sarah, you already said that. The flavor will probably be different, but there's their generic, like, X teaspoons of turmeric equals X inches fresh.
Not that I know. I mean, exactly.
Right.
No, but...
If you're using it, would you take the fresh, and then, like, if you're using it in a paste, would you mash it and then put it in your measuring spoon? Or how would you... Is that how people would be measuring like to it measure for the recipe?
No, usually it'll go by inch. Like, it'll say, like, an inch of turmeric or something.
So I need a ruler in the kitchen if I'm going to work with
turmeric. Yes. You don't have to be so accurate with that.
I need recipes, though. You know this.
And then you're just do you use like a microplane or do you just throw it in a processor?
You can do it either way, but if you are going to grate it, then, you know, your grater, you know, if your grater is stainless steel, you're going to be fine. It's not going to dye it. If you're going to put it in the food processor, it's going to dye your food processor. So just know that.
Mm.
If it's the same thing, like when people start to get into making like nut milks or...
Right. You might want to have your own specific...
Yeah, just know if you're using your Vitamix will never look the same again after making a turmeric latte or whatever, nut milk time.
Right.
So just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
It's but it doesn't impart flavor and it won't leach extra color. You've just literally stained the plastic.
It's just stained. Yeah.
Cutting boards.
Cashmere sweaters that you knew you should have taken off before you started cooking.
Yep. All those things. I mean, I always like to, if I have learned a lesson, I like to share it with people so they don't also have to learn that lesson.
Or if you have like a quartz countertop, will it dye that too?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It does not discriminate. It's going to leave its mark on everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, good to know. All right. Well, I think we've covered a lot.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, if there's any... Like, I think I've been meaning to make this golden latte... So many names. Moon milk, golden latte, turmeric latte.
I don't like moon milk at all.
I think that's a specific Bon Appetit recipe that has a lot of adaptogens and other things in it. But I don't know. So I think some other cool things popped up. I definitely want to start putting it in soup. I always make chicken stock. We always buy a whole chicken and I always roast it and then I always make stock. And it's so funny because one time I did Instacart, I got my groceries delivered and I got like a tray of legs instead of a whole chicken. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know what to do with this. Like, right? Because all I ever do is roast the whole chicken. I mean, I eventually figured it out. But the moment of panic that was like, wait, what? I'm not going to be able to make stock. Because I'm always thinking of at least three dishes that I can make with this one chicken. But there's always homemade stock in our fridge. And I want to try. I want my knees not to ache.
Yeah. Add it into your life.
Yeah. And if you're saving all your vegetable scraps, it's just so easy to do.
Turmeric it up.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, we'll leave it there.
I don't know. What's our next? Do we have anything?
We don't have a next thing. We haven't figured it out yet.
We should go to the market and see what they have.
I think,
have we done leeks?
No.
We haven't done leeks. Also, Romanesco. Cabbage. How do you feel about cabbage? I can't decide if you're a cabbage fan.
Oh, I love cabbage. Love it. We're not big noodle fans, so when we do soups, we'll do cabbage instead of noodles. I know. It just got weird right at the end of turmeric.
How do you not like... No, I mean, sometimes you eat too many noodles and you feel very bloated and tired. I get it. Maybe you don't want to feel that way.
It's perfect for how dark it is because then you just go to sleep and burn all that weight off.
like rice noodles, no. Egg noodles, no.
No, we'll eat noodles. Like I'll do like dandan noodles or something, but Sarah's not like a huge pasta person.
Yeah.
And so our favorite thing in the soup is usually the vegetables. And yeah. So yeah. We'll just add some cabbage. Kind of mirrors that situation if you're doing that.
Yeah. I think Savoy cabbage could be fun to explore.
Yeah, I don't know specific varieties, really.
Savoy is the one that is all, like, crepey and just looks like beautiful fabric. Oh, okay. It's gorgeous.
It's the Instagram cabbage.
It's Instagram cabbage, but when you cut it open and open it up, there's not that many leaves, I feel like. There's not a lot to actually cook with, and it has a more endive-esque flavor. Mm.
Endive.
No, that's not right. Radicchio, that's what I meant. It's bitter. Ah. I was trying to not show my bias there. But yeah, it's a little bitter. But I think you're right. I think it's market tour time.
Yeah, let's go check it out.
Yeah, and then we'll have brunch.
Yes. With our golden girl.
Even better.
Done and done. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, that's it. That is the show. Thanks so much for listening. As always, please send your feedback to pdxfoodstories.com. We'll be back here pretty soon looking at some spring vegetables as Portland starts to awaken from winter. Until then, have a great week.